the story I like to say is that I was going to a Wall Street Journal event that I was speaking at, and I landed in the morning in Newark at 5:30. I was curbside by 6:30. I get into my Uber, and an hour and 15 minutes later, I was in Tribeca. That's not very far. I could have did that trip in about 7 to 10 minutes in an eVTOL, right? So the use case has been made.
Welcome to Sustainability in the Air, the world's first podcast dedicated to sustainable aviation. I'm your host, Shashank Nigam, the CEO of Simply Flying. Every Thursday, I have important conversations with top aviation executives, technology entrepreneurs, and policymakers helping aviation take climate action. Conversations that help separate the signal from the noise. Whether you are a frequent flyer or an airline executive, if you care about sustainability or simply love traveling, welcome aboard. My guest today is Billy Nolan. Billy is the Chief Safety Officer at Archer, the eVTOL company that hopes to have electric vertical takeoff and landing vehicles in service by 2025. Billy is the former administrator of the Federal Aviation Administration in the US, the FAA, and hence has a lot of experience setting safety standards for the industry in aviation, not just airplanes, but also helicopters and eVTOLs. I remember interacting with him when he was VP of Safety at WestJet during the COVID years. He's come a long way. He's now heading safety at Archer, one of the hottest startups when it comes to eVTOLs. And we discuss everything safety, FAA, credibility, and internationalization of eVTOLs. Let's hear it from Billy. Billy, welcome to the show. It is great to be finally speaking. Can you please update our listeners on the latest progress regarding Archer's Midnight, getting it certified and into production?
Yeah, so first of all, thank you for having me on the show. That, as you said, you know, it would have been great if we could have done this, you know, last year. But, you know, the universe has a way of bringing us together at exactly the right time. So it's just fantastic to be with your audience today. Let me say where we are. So we're proud to say that we are moving quite smartly through the certification process with the FAA, where we are starting this process, right? We've received our G1 cert basis and our airworthiness criteria. We've delivered our what we call our means of compliance to the FAA. We're working through our certification plan. You've seen, and the public has seen, that our Archer Midnight aircraft is flying. This is our prototype, of course, and that's out doing daily flying. We've gone through a series of tests. We've actually completed the first phase of that. We are now ready to move into the second phase. We announced just yesterday that our first three fully conforming Midnight aircraft are in production. So as those roll out, we will move into what's called the four-credit flight testing. This is where we go through a testing regime that our design specification, that we can test those, that they are there in a fully, what we call a fully conforming aircraft. So as we get through this and we work with the FAA, the last piece of regulatory framework that the FAA has to deliver is the what we call the operational framework, how the pilots will fly, what kind of time they will need, energy reserve requirements and things like that. So the FAA put that out for comment last year, and the comment period closed last August. They're in the process of working through all of those comments with an expectation, Shashank, that they will finalize that Special Federal Aviation Regulation, or SFAR, sometime in the fall of this year. That, and if that indeed proves to be the case, that keeps us on our timeline of entry into service and start, receiving our type certificate and entry into service sometime in 2025.
You've just recently joined, and yeah, you've come from across the table. You've had a distinguished career at the FAA. What drew you to a fast-growing startup, I would say, still an advanced startup like Archer?
Yeah, you know, I've thought about that. Now, I will say I spent the better part of my four decades in aviation, have been in, to your point, have been in a classic sense. I've been at three airlines. I was an airline captain. Coming to the FAA was just one of the highlights of, you know, my overarching career, that chance to lead and be in the forefront of leading regulation, maintaining the safety and sustainability for the flying public. And so as I look to wind down my FAA career last year, I was asked by, you know, the administration to stay on, but I felt it was time for me to return to private industry. And as I was looking, what drew me to Archer was, you know, number one, the vision and passion that I saw in Adam Goldstein, you know, the CEO and founder, meeting with the other executive, but not only the executive, just meeting with the Archer team, this sense of excitement, this buzz that I felt. You know, we've got a couple of top executives. This is their eighth full-scale eVTOL that they've worked on, right? So I feel having that, you know, that requisite depth of knowledge and expertise in this, what we call this new and novel sector of the, you know, aerospace, electrical vertical takeoff and landing aircraft, or electric air taxis to keep it to a shorter sense. That's what drew me there. I've been excited. I'm closing in on 8 months here at Archer. And I, you know, I'm just as excited as the first day that I joined.
This is very, very exciting. In your previous role, you used to ensure that new startups like Archer conformed to the safety standards set by the FAA. How does that experience actually translate? Does that help Archer comply better with regulators and regulation?
Yeah, well, it's an excellent question. So when you think about it, yeah, absolutely. My role, the hat I wore as a regulator, and certainly when I sat in the chair as the FAA administrator, when, you know, was asked by the president to do that on a, you know, an acting basis, was to ensure that always that the public is safe, and whatever that we oversee, what we call the regulated entities at that time, being Archer, Boeing, Airbus, etc., that they were adhering to those standards. So now bringing all of that, you know, what I call the wisdom of my four decades in commercial aviation and aviation safety and operational excellence, I have this, you know, I think I have somewhat of a unique, you know, outlook because I've seen so much. I understand what good safety look like, what good safety management look like. I understand the regulatory regime and just how rigorous it is by design, because obviously what we say is once you put the first paying customer passenger on something, it has to be absolutely safe. So I'm able to then bring those, you know, that years of knowledge into what's essentially is a startup, and it's an opportunity for me to continue to learn. I've always believed in being a lifelong learner. So that ability to come here and listen to some really, really smart people, educate them from my perspective, but to be educated by them from theirs, I think has provided a level of excitement that, you know what, I don't know that I was expecting that at first, but I've really come to appreciate it.
I'm glad you have this perspective that you bring to Archer, which still is a startup compared to, you know, big behemoths like Boeing, for example. And Well, let's address the elephant in the room. The FAA right now has boots on the ground at Boeing, which is a very large company with years and years of manufacturing experience. Here, Archer is just starting out. What gives you the confidence that Archer can meet and exceed the standards? FAA now will look at everyone just because of what's happening at Boeing.
Yeah, so it's another excellent question. When we think about it, so the certification pathway is fairly straightforward, right? There's no ambiguity here, if you will. There might be some points of which you need some sort of policy interpretation, but overall, it's very well laid out. Yeah, and so think back, the FAA in 2018, they stood up something called the Center for Emerging Concepts and Innovation. And this office was designed to take new and novel ideas, talk to, you know, the founders, the entrepreneurs, and get a sense that number one, they had a depth in terms of the engineering expertise to be able to do it, that the concept was sound, that it was something indeed that could pass through the regulatory, you know, process, if you will, and come out the other side as a safe, viable mode of transportation. So when you know, this is the benefit that not only Archer, but if you look at, take it at a macro level, Shashank, this entire sector, new the novel sector of the market, we have an opportunity to look at everything that's gone before. From the earliest days, we can trace this all the way back to the Wright brothers at Kitty Hawk, right? To be able to, we can see that. And so it helps inform not only our decision, our engineering, our, you know, you bring all of that to bear. And so, you know, we know what the bar is because the bar has already been set. We know what the certification because it's fairly straightforward. So that allows us to move forward working in concert, coordination, and partnership with FAA in their oversight role to make sure that out the other side of that is Archer Midnight comes to market as one of the safest, you know, modes of transportation, you know, out there, period, full stop.
So this brings me back to the early days of, let's say, McDonnell Douglas and, yes, and Boeing and Lockheed Martin, because you can't compare it with the big aircraft of today that with thousands in production. Archer is really bringing Midnight as the first eVTOL to market, hoping to gain certification with some others like Joby and a couple of others, which have made advanced progress. You have no benchmark. You're just starting out, right? So you are setting the standard to be judged upon by yourself. I wonder what the discussion is like around who sets the standard. Europe has not seen. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So because, again, when we think about, you know, the basics of the fundamentals of aerodynamics or your sound, those haven't changed, right? The fundamentals, how one constructs a design, what is your, you know, what is, you know, when you think of how you build an aircraft or a vehicle or some mode of conveyance, right? It's fairly certain. And so you're sitting down, you're working with certain engineers. You know, I've been a captain on a McDonnell Douglas. I flew the MD-80 for in excess of 10 years as captain. I've flown the Boeing 75, the Boeing 76, understanding. But in many respects, right, we are building something that what we like to say has zero single points of failure. Now, I've, you know, for the audience, I've got about 4,000 hours of helicopter time myself. You've got a main, in the helicopters I flew, you had a main rotor, you got a tail rotor. Either one of those failed, you're into a very serious and critical situation. You look at Archer Midnight, which has 12 propellers, you know, 6 two-bladed ones on the back and 6 five-bladed ones on the front. You've already designed in multiple layers of redundancies. Another way in which Archer, that I think makes us in many respects unique, we decided we didn't want to do all that ourselves. That is, we didn't take the path of vertical integration that we were going to do it all. That adds to complexity because you've got to convince the regulators that everything you do, you know, sort of matches up. So we chose, and I would say this was just a phenomenal decision on the part of Adam in the early days, right? We chose to go partner with top tier suppliers like Garmin, like Honeywell, like Safran, like FACC in terms of composite. These are companies and organizations that are very well versed in the entire certification ecosystem, if you will. They are known entities, not just to the FAA, but to EASA in Europe, the European Aviation Safety Agency, or Transport Canada, or ANAC in Brazil, right? So these are known entities. So we think that gives us another leg up, right? And so we did the things that we say we could only do. Our engines are proprietary. Our motors are proprietary, right? Our battery management system is proprietary to Archer. But where we can partner, we've done so. And part of that is so not only that we could get to market faster and safer, right, with a phenomenal design, but it also gives the regulator that sense of comfort because those folks and those, you know, suppliers that I talked about are already known entities.
This is fantastic. So you are basically firing from the shoulders of giants. You're partnering with companies and others who have the trust of regulators and customers. Since we're talking about partnerships, I'm wondering if we can talk a little about your partnership with Stellantis, which used to manufacture or still is a car manufacturer.
It's still
And a vehicle manufacturer. And now they'll be manufacturing Archer eVTOLs. How does that work? How is that panning out?
Well, so when you think about it, again, going back to that vision, is that you think about, say, what kind of partnership? You know, Stellantis is, of course, a major investor, one of the world's biggest automotive manufacturers, think brands like Maserati, like Jeep, you know, and others. So they are very skilled at what they do. So when we move from what we call a low rate production that we are doing at the moment, remember I spoke earlier about the first three of these are already in production. We'll produce the first, you know, six of that as we move in. But as we start to scale, you want to be with a partner who understands and can help you scale, right? And so we're building this factory in Covington, Georgia, about 30, 35 miles just to the east, southeast of Atlanta. And that partnership with Stellantis will allow us to grow. Phase one of that, we'll be able to do about 650 vehicles a year with the capability to scale that up to 2,300, right? So when you start getting to those levels that you have a repetitive design, you can think of, you know, others, you know, Volkswagen Group, et cetera, right? That ability to partner with someone like an entity like Stellantis brings a level, not only a level of confidence, but expertise in mass production. And I think that's something that certainly will serve us well as we really start to scale into, you know, global operations.
So let's go step by step. Way before scaling is first flights, testing, entering to service. Yes. Let's say, you know, in partnership with United. What are the safety concerns from a general passenger perspective that you're trying to address? Because as we understand, Archer is piloted. It's not a autonomous vehicle like what Wisk is developing, for example. So that's gone. There is a pilot. And that leaves how many passengers will be there? What do you think there are there concerns from a safety perspective and how are you addressing them?
Yeah, this is an excellent point. So I think there, you know, to address, you know, your point from concept, something on a clean sheet of paper to that comes out the other side, that's been type certified, that's received an airworthiness certificate from the FAA, and an airline or an operator has received an aircraft operating certificate to be able to go operate and now put paying customers aboard. You need a few things to happen. So battery technology, first and foremost, batteries have come a long way and they continue to evolve and improve at the rate of about 5 to 7% per year. So the public will rightfully expect, number one, what's your battery design like and is it safe? We've designed ours, you know, ours will be 6 proprietary, the way ours are put together, 6 battery packs in the wings between each set of engines, if you will. We've got, again, proprietary battery management system that our team has developed that we use there. So first and foremost, you've got to be able to demonstrate to the FAA that you have to try to induce, for example, a thermal runaway and ensure that doesn't propagate across batteries. So you've got to prove that your battery designs are safe. We're talking electrical propulsion, right? No one is using that sort of at scale today. It's certainly not in aviation. So now you've got to be able to prove out your motor, the designs of your motors. Ours is somewhat simple, but, you know, complex at the same time. It's only got 7 moving parts, right? But you've got to, you know, what's the rigorous, testing that must be done that you have to demonstrate to the regulator in terms of its, not only of its suitability, but its reliability as well. So you got the engines, you got the propellers, you've got, you know, ours, you have, you know, an air condition. But the good thing about all of this is that we have less complexity than the commercial airliners that I flew as a pilot and as a captain, right? You don't have pressurization. You don't have pneumatics. You don't have, you know, these really incredible electronic systems that, you know, on, say, a Boeing 787 or an Airbus A350. So in some respects, you've got less complexity, yet at the same time, we're going, certainly for Archer, we're going down the path of making sure that we've got, you know, multiple, triple, quadruple levels of redundancies built into this so that we answer off the question, how safe is it? What I say is, once we come out the other side, once the FAA, you know, certifies Archer Midnight, it will be as certifiably safe as climbing aboard a Boeing 787 or an Airbus A350, right? This is the path that we're on. So, and that's what we've said. Now, look, one thing I would say, if you look at the universe of, say, helicopters today, roughly about 50,000 helicopters globally. Most people don't really think twice. Yeah, I mean, there are some nervous flies out there, maybe rightfully, but most people don't think twice about getting on helicopters. So we are moving into a vehicle or into an aircraft that's got imminently more levels of redundancy built in, and we've architected in a way with what we call zero single points of failure. And we think that kind of design will engender in the flying public a level of confidence and trust that, number one, that we are safe, but we are safe and that we have been built to a certifiable standard.
It's interesting you mentioned battery.
Yes.
I had a Tesla. I was one of the early adopters. And everyone who did not have a Tesla and came and asked me about a Tesla, first question, range anxiety.
Yes.
Second question, hey, did you see that viral video of a Tesla battery on fire?
Yeah.
Now, we are bringing electric to the air for the first time through eVTOLs. Electric airplanes are quite far away. eVTOLs will bring this. Do you get questions like, oh, what if we run out of battery halfway through? Or what do we do? Oh, what if there's a battery fire? How will that change? Yeah. How do you address such simple notions that often maybe misconceptions from electric vehicles and others that people are just applying to a new mode of transport?
Yeah.
And how do you address them?
And it's an excellent question. It's an excellent question. And you know, these are the things in terms of how we have the right conversations with the flying public, especially as we enter new era. The same kind of questions as you just mentioned that you get, whether you're in a Tesla or a Rivian or Lucid or any other, you know, something that's fully electrified. And so what we say, well, let's go back to the basics. So Archer Midnight is an aircraft that is designed with a pilot plus four passengers and a carry-on bag to be able to have a range of roughly 100 miles, the ability to fly up to 150 miles an hour. Now, if you look at what the typical, you know, what we call mission profile or the typical, you know, trip segment will be, it's roughly something between, say, 20 and 40 miles, right? And so you're taking, let's just imagine the starter day, you've got a full charge from the time you say you pick up passengers at, let's use an airport, let's say you pick someone up at, you know, at Newark International, you take them to the Midtown Manhattan Airport, you drop them off. The time it takes to drop them off, check the others in, you've, you know, 10, 15 minutes, you've done a rapid, what you call a rapid recharge, gets you back up to about 80% of the performance of the battery, and a similar way of doing a rapid recharge on a EV, right? And so, and then there are times maybe that you have longer segments that you have time where you do an even longer, where maybe a 30 minute, which may get you back to a full charge of 100%. So what we say, if you look at where we are, and one of the things that we have to demonstrate is what we call our reserve requirements, right? You know, when you think of a conventional helicopter airplane, that's how much additional fuel do you have to go to a spot? You know, maybe that spot is not available. You have to go to what we call an alternate spot, and that ability to go there and land. That's what you call reserve. And so in something that's electrified, that's an energy reserve, right? How much reserve do you have? Let's say if I take you to an airport, I can't land there and I need to land you at an alternative site. So those are just the kinds of things that the FAA will address through this special federal aviation regulation that we'll see, you know, in the fall of this year.
This is very interesting. I know I've worked with airlines and OEMs manufacturers for a long time, and safety is something they do not compete on.
Absolutely.
Does Archer look to differentiate itself on its safety levels, or will the FAA's safety regulations apply equally to all eVTOL providers?
They will apply equally, and we are going to say the same thing. We will never compete nor compromise on safety, right? Because this is the area, and again, I take it back. So think about that's if I put my, you know, FAA hat back on, you think of it at a macro level. Let's say, what is that requisite level of safety that apply? Now, there might be something novel about one particular design over another, meaning someone may have, instead of R12, they may have 6, they may have 8, et cetera. They may have 4 battery pack or 6. So there might be some slight nuances there, but that's what the certification process is designed to address. So you go in and you say, what's my type design? What is it I'm kind of certified? And then you have to demonstrate to the FAA that indeed, if you say it can do X, it must be demonstrably able to do X before you receive a type certification. So that's a whole part of the process. Now, I think one of the lessons that this industry, as it begins to take off in the next few years, can learn from conventional aviation, especially the airlines, is how they come together around issues of safety. Now, issues of competitiveness, you know, yeah, we're going to go out there and sort of kick butt and take name, if you will, and everybody's going to do the same thing. But then there's another opportunity to say, hey, what are we seeing? What are the lessons learned? What, you know, are there, you know, to the extent that you have something that comes up, that crops up, you may have an incident. I'm not talking about anything critical, right? But you share what we call safety best practices, right? So our ability to be able to sort of ride on the shoulders of what the industry is currently already doing when it comes to safety management. That's, you know, this is, we don't have to go, you know, you don't have to, you know, build new ground. You don't have to turn over, you know, there's this path has already been set by those that have gone before us in terms of what good safety management looks like. So it'll be an opportunity for us to build on that even more when we think about these connected systems, when we think of the kind of data we see. It will allow us to move into what I call a fully predictive type modeling, you know, in terms of where we go and how we, you know, how we deploy these midnight aircraft around the world.
So let's talk about around the world. You're not just looking to pilot this in the US. I saw a real version at our book launch, actually, in the UAE at Dubai Air Show. Yes. How is working with the regulators in a place like UAE different or similar to from the FAA? Will they just look at what the FAA is asking for and apply it in the UAE? How is it different or similar?
Well, you know, so again, let me put my FAA hat on for a minute. So during the course of my time at the FAA, I had a chance to meet with over 50 director generals of civil aviation around the world. I was in the Singapore Air Show in February of 2022. I was at Farnborough in 2022. I was in Le Bourget last year. I was in Brazil. I've been to the UAE. I've met with the regulatory authorities in the UAE and elsewhere around the world. So they recognize the U.S., the FAA has been, you know, considered the gold, you know, the gold standard for not only for safety regulations, but for federal, you know, regulations, right? And so, but having said that, there's this close working relationship among the regulators, right? So when we go and talk to regulators elsewhere and say, we want to come and operate in your country, in your market, they've already got a sense of comfort. They know that once it gets through the certification process, be it the FAA, be it the EASA, there's a level. So there's something to the quick explanation for your audience, right? The U.S., in the case of Archer, is the state of design and also the state of manufacture. You know, to the extent that we go elsewhere, we'll think about that. But at the moment, that's where we are. So other countries, other civil aviation authorities would be they would do a validation process of the FAA's type certificate. So as we progress through and we receive our type certificate for Archer Midnight, it would be then incumbent upon another country or EASA to validate the design that has been blessed by the FAA, if you will. And conversely, you look at Volocopter, which will be, you know, certified, type certified by EASA, the European Aviation Safety Agency, it would be validated by the U.S. Or even Brazil would be certified by ANAC and validated. So you've got this process of certification and validation of that certification prior to it operating in another country, right? So that's kind of what the process is like on a global basis. We feel very comfortable that the regulators have a great deal of trust and confidence in the FAA. And we're going to continue to work through both with all of those entities, you know, as we really roll out this to market, both here at home and abroad.
Thank you, Billy. And I love that you have this FAA hat, formerly from the FAA and now to Archer. I do want to push back a little bit on this.
Sure.
Do you feel that the FAA's international credibility has taken a hit since the incidents at Boeing due to no doing of yours here at Archer? And do you think that might have an impact on the certification process at Archer?
No, the FAA is a big entity. Let me, you know, the FAA is made up of nearly 45,000 men and women. When I joined the FAA in January of 2022, I led the aviation safety services where much of this sausage making take place, certification, flight standards, rulemaking, incident investigation, et cetera. And I had a staff of of 7,000, 600 men and women that I led. And then when I was asked by the administration to step into the role of administrator, now I've got 44,000 with a budget of about $25 billion. The FAA is, part of what makes our system so safe and so resilient is that you've got these processes that are built in. Safety management systems. Initially it was a Part 121 operation of the major airlines. That is now being extended to the OEMs, the original equipment manufacturers, to Part 91, Part 135 operators, air tour operators, etc. So you're overlaying this standard across all of the stakeholders within the aviation ecosystem. So as I think about the role of the FAA, will something happen? Absolutely. It is the nature of aviation. What you want that to be is something that's not catastrophic. What we want is safety resilience. That is, you see, there could be a incident. There might be a mishap. It is the role of both the FAA and the regulated entity to be able to steer into that and say, is there something that we missed, either from the regulator's perspective or from the regulated entity perspective? And this, since we're kind of talking about, but it's from Boeing's perspective, from agency. And that's a good opportunity for us, Shashank, to sit back and say, okay, how did this happen? What, is there, if there's a process failure, if there's a control failure, and we look for it and say, how do we ensure that that doesn't happen again? I can tell you, point of fact, that when I was the FAA administrator, I had ongoing dialogue with EASA, with ANAC, with Transport Canada, with all of the major ones. I would then be meeting my colleagues, whether it be vis-a-vis an NICAO type meeting, et cetera. So this is ongoing. Why? It is so that we can continue to maintain that this level of safety, not just here at home, right? But nationally. I know that's a bit of that's a long-winded answer, but I do think the FAA, they're up for the task. I will say, and it's funny that you mentioned this, is by the time this airs, right? Hopefully Congress will have approved the FAA's full reauthorization. And this is what you need, this steady consistency, so that the FAA administrator, that whoever's in the role is now he, but whether it's a he or she, have the resources they need to be able to do that level of oversight well.
Thank you so much for that detailed answer. I could have expected nothing less. And, this totally elevates the conversation. And thank you for the context. Thanks. Now, we have to understand that eVTOLs do not operate intercity route. You won't be flying from Los Angeles to New York or Los Angeles to Chicago. Instead, you might be flying over from Los Angeles to Long Beach, California for the Olympics. Or there might be a United Airlines shuttle flight from Newark, New Jersey to Manhattan. You're basically dealing with local authorities and cities, not necessarily national airspace. What kind of pushback do you get from local cities when you suggest, let's have an eVTOL service overhead at low altitude, no cabin pressurization? What kind of discussions do you have with local cities and what is the pushback?
Well, I think you started, again, let's go back to at a federal level from the perspective of the FAA. You need an airspace. So another key enabler is to have what I call an airspace integration plan. So one of the things that we worked very hard on during my time is to lay out a concept of operation. I called it Innovate 2028. It was a forcing function that says by the time we get to the LA Olympics, do we have the ability at scale to overlay, hundreds of eVTOL flies, about tens of thousands of drones that are already, the U.S. airspace has got about 3 million plus drones already out there today, right? That will continue to scale. So that ability to have a strong integration plan in terms of what the FAA use. When eVTOLs initially come to market, and we say in 2025 and beyond, the first phase of that will just be using day VFR routing that it's already that helicopters are using today. You will see no additional demands on the air traffic control system, right? And as you get to scale, the FAA is already thinking about, as well as NASA, is say, what is the future of air traffic control looks like as you scale eVTOL operations in cities across the world? That's at a federal level. Then one of the next thing you have to do is start to think about the infrastructure requirements, not only for airports around the world. You know, the U.S. has got about 5,000, you know, airports. It's got about the same number of helipads and heliports out there. Not all of those are public, but quite a few are, right? So that ability to say, what do we need for charging infrastructure? So cities are starting to think about, and certainly the major cities, you know, New York, Dallas, L.A., Chicago, Miami, and Philadelphia, Boston, elsewhere, right? No one wants to be left behind. So this is it's an exciting time because everyone said, well, how can that work? I know I've talked to people, what if I could get from, you know, I'm here in Washington, D.C. If I could get from, say, you know, Reagan to Baltimore, because you know what? I'm not a flight, but I can be there now in 15 minutes versus an hour on the Beltway, right? I mean, it doesn't take much to convince. You know, the story I like to say is that I was going to a Wall Street Journal event that I was speaking at, and I landed in the morning in Newark at 5:30. I was curbside by 6:30. I get into my Uber, and an hour and 15 minutes later, I was in Tribeca. That's not very far. I could have did that trip in about 7 to 10 minutes in an eVTOL, right? So the use case has been made. What we have to now do is to work in close partnership and collaboration with airport authorities, with city authorities, with city officials and state officials to say, how do we implement this safely? Because it will be safe. How do we do it well? And how do we ensure that level of infrastructure that they're thinking about today, but should be thinking about tomorrow, that is all in place to be able to enable this?
Wow, fantastic. I love the kind of engagement that is needed on different levels. Right. We were talking about UAE a minute ago, and now we're talking about local cities. It's so critical. Talk to us about the infrastructure that cities and airports will need to provide. Can you just have a Tesla supercharger to charge at midnight? Or is new infrastructure needed on top of a helipad? What is needed that is not there already?
Yeah, so we, you know, the U.S. has already put out, you know, another document that was done during my time, and it continued to evolve, is design standards for vertiports. You know, this term that we're now using as we talk about, you know, eVTOLs. But we got a lot of helipads out there today that you can cross utilize for both helicopter and for eVTOL operation, right? So let's figure out how we go do that. Maybe there is some level of, you know, of reengineering that you might have a helipad that's already built in that you just need some charging infrastructure. You won't need that at every point. So it's those kind of things. So as city begin to think about, and airports begin to think about what parts do we have that is underutilized? How do we enable this? You know, you've got lots. If you take a big airport, they've got helicopters operating. They've got, you know, commercial, of course, airplanes operating. They've got biz jets operating. So they're very, you know, these are little, you know, entire ecosystems unto themselves, right? And then you think to your earlier comment, say, how do I get from LA to Long Beach? When I think about what that means and where I'm at, what are the landing opportunities? Where might we put stuff that supports not only the major airport, but the communities as well, especially as we think about inner city operations, which is primarily Archer's business model.
This is good to know in terms of what else is needed to enable these flights.
Yes.
Talk to us more about consumer education. What do you think is going to be needed to convince them to board this completely new form of aircraft or transport mode?
Well, I'll just give you a quick anecdote, my own story. So, you know, here someone, you know, born in Alabama, grew up as a boy, you know, lived in New York, went to California, joined the military, was going to university, and I became a pilot, became an officer and a pilot in the military. I remember one of my first, to fly helicopters, I was in a little Hughes 300. I'd go out for what they call your nickel ride, where it'd take you out for 30 minutes. Say, well, what do you think? You know, it's February, I'm in lower Alabama, I've got thick clothes on, but I'm sweating. You go, ooh, can I do this? So I recognize, you know, if I go back to that and then come all the way forward to today, are the safety systems that we have are incredibly advanced, and they have evolved to such a extent that you've just got this really connected environment. I think what we must do, you know, whether it be an Archer, but also as an industry, is this: what is the level of public education? It's not a massive jump to say you go from a helicopter to an eVTOL. People have already flown helicopters, and they do it day in and day out. So it's not like we're not, you know, this isn't an impulse engine. This is not Star Trek or Star Wars, right? We're not doing warp drives here. So in the end, what are we talking about? We're talking about, you know, electrical propulsion. We're talking about things like vector thrust, where the propellers on the front and back move to a, you know, to a vertical and then to a horizontal position, and ensuring that those actuators, are they tested and designed to a level of safety that the public expects? What is the level of noise, right? You've got something that on order of magnitude has got about, you know, 90 to 100 times less than noise signature of a conventional helicopter. So these are the kinds. So I think the more the public sees, and this is really what you will begin to see more of in 2024, it is, we'll be doing lots of flying. Others will be doing lots of flying. So the more we see it, and now I say, oh yeah, they're flying all the time. It is for us to go and have those kind of education forums and every opportunity. You're incredibly good at what you do. So this is an opportunity to educate the public in terms of, this is coming. Yeah, what gives you pause? You know, what answers would you like about, and what might you think, oh, did they get that right? And this is our opportunity, as we, between now and the time we put that first paying passenger aboard Archer Midnight, is to answer off those questions and answer off those concerns.
So when is the first paying passenger going to be on a Midnight flight? Do we have a date?
Yeah, no, let me just say, you know, our goal, and this is where the team and I and Adam and all of us at Archer are, we are focused on getting through the rigorous certification process. Is rigorous by design. It needs to be safe, and it's certified to a standard. So we're working to that. We're not in total control of our destiny, if you will. But we believe at the pace that we're going, right, that we are still expecting that we will receive our type certificate, TC, and entry into service in 2025. And that's what all of us are focused on. And we are working very closely with the FAA, with the certification teams. There's still, as I mentioned, there's still one more, you know, significant piece of that regulatory framework that needs to be put in place. Our expectation, the FAA will have that in place by this fall. And so we're just going to work as hard as we can. All of that comes about, you know, I'd love to be able to tell you, you know, here's exactly the date. But what I can tell you is that we are doing everything within our power as a company, right, to hit that date of being in, you know, receiving that certificate and being in service in 2025.
Right. Now, 2025 is incredibly close. Yet, yes. EVTOLs, not just yeah. Archer, EVTOLs have their share of skeptics. Some people believe, yes. it's a niche transport for the super rich, people who take helicopters. Now, I mean, I don't think 1% of the population of the world would have stepped on a helicopter, probably much lesser, much fewer than that. So what do you say to those?
What we say is, you know, look at, you know, if you look at our, you know, our vision statement or our motto is, you know, unlock the skies. That ability to reimagine our worlds and our, you know, the world is an incredibly, it's a densely populated place in many respects, in our major cities. There's a level of congestion there. We're seeing the rapid advancements and moving toward electrification of automobiles, right? So this is really becomes a natural progression. Our goal at Archer is to have Midnight the first few that come to market, you're probably in the category of an Uber Black range. That's about where you are in terms of a price point. But as we get to scales, you're saying, we see that coming down to Uber X price. And that is what we've designed it around. Again, I go back to Adam's vision. I know you've had him on this, right? Is think about what the business use case and then design, build, and architect a vehicle that meets that. That's not what everybody does. Some folks go and build something and say, ooh, how might I use this? And what's my use case, right? We've done that. You know, we've sort of take that. I call it reverse engineering. Here's the outcome we want to achieve. Now, how do we go about getting there? And that's really what you see in Archer's Midnight. Now, that being said, it has to be sustainable. It has to be accessible. It has to have this, to your point, this degree of affordability is that. And if that's not there, then probably we would have failed, right? It's to meet those expectations of the flying public. What we have been saying, not only to the public, but to regulators and government officials as well, is that we have designed Midnight to be an affordable mode of transportation to allow. Will everybody take advantage of it? No, to your point, helicopters. But I suspect that as more people see just what this has done in allowing us to reimagine how we live and move, that certainly the numbers will be quite large.
I'm glad to hear, because I can't wait to board an eVTOL and pay the price of an Uber X. How about Uber Pool? Because there are multiple passengers. Maybe Uber Pool one day. Yeah. But Uber X. Uber X.
I think that's right.
To begin with.
Yeah, I think as you get there, you'll see more.
Billy, I really appreciate you diving deep and not shying away from the tough questions around safety regulations and painting a vision of what this might look like not too far from now in 2025. Now, the final section of this interview is what I call the rapid fire round. We had a lot of fun with Adam from Archer doing this as well, and we're going to have some fun here as well. So I'll ask simple questions and you have to give me one line reply. So we'll start simple. What's your favorite airline, Billy?
My favorite airline is Emirates.
Okay, well done. Well, you're doing work in the UAE. Hopefully that should help you get more onto Emirates. What's your favorite airport?
My favorite airport is Los Angeles International.
No way. LAX Tom Bradley?
LAX Tom Bradley. Yeah.
Okay. May I ask why? Okay, Sunset. No, okay,
you know,
good.
It works well. They've got a great design. You know, you've got a level of international and domestic traffic out there. I love the way the airport is sort of set up. It's got a strong leadership there. There are the great airports. But for me, as a pilot, right, flying into and out of LAX is something I have always enjoyed.
And I, as a non-pilot, love to go spotting there at the In-N-Out Burger. Yeah. So I know what you're talking about. What is your favorite city?
My favorite city, I'll have to say two if you'll allow me. Number
Please.
One is Sydney. Sydney, Australia would be my first, and my second would be Washington, D.C.
Wow. Okay. And I think you've lived in Washington for quite some time, isn't it?
I have, yes. This is my second go-round in Washington.
Well, it should help that you know, you're living in your favorite city, so that definitely helps. Yes. What's your favorite movie, Billy?
Favorite movie is the Lord of the Rings trilogy.
Okay. You're a fantasy man. Have you read the books as well?
Yeah, I have.
Okay. What is something that you would like to learn?
I want to learn to be able to move from being preventive to a mode where I can be and we can be fully predictable.
Okay, very nice. I love this. This is deep and applies to work as well. What do you do in your free time?
Free time, my cycle. My focus this year is on health and well-being. So between cycling, going to the gym, I love music, I love concerts, I love art, and I love travel.
Okay, cycling. What is the best advice you've received, Billy?
Best advice is never forget the fundamentals and is always about basic blocking and tackling. If you get that right, you can build from there and go on to have a great deal of success.
Okay. And finally, if we are speaking 1 year from now and we are popping champagne, what are we celebrating?
A year from now, we are celebrating, if all goes as I hope that it will, we are celebrating that we are nearly there. That we have had a great deal of success, that we've hit some major milestones that we set for ourselves, and we can see the endpoint in sight in terms of our entry into service.
Okay, fantastic. I do wish you all the best, and hopefully we will catch
up
in a year and do this together. Billy, it was a pleasure speaking.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for the insightful replies.
Thank you very much. Great to be on today. You're a master interviewer. So
we do our research. I have a fantastic team supporting me here. So, I really enjoyed this. And like I said, I was looking forward to doing this for over a year. So I'm glad we finally spoke.
I'm glad we did it.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to this episode of Sustainability in the Air. Aviation is one of the hardest to decarbonize industries. Yet, there are multiple paths to get to net zero. Awareness is key to a green future. So please give us your support to help our sustainable aviation insights reach a wider audience. You can do this by sharing this episode on your network, on LinkedIn, Twitter, or even WhatsApp. Or perhaps you might consider leaving a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to this episode. You can start a conversation with us by writing to us at podcast@simplifying.com. And for more content on sustainable aviation, please visit our website, green.simplifying.com, and join the movement. Sustainability in the Air is an original podcast by Simply Flying. The show is produced by Juraj Tov in Slovakia. Dirk Singer is our Director of Sustainability, who leads research for each interviewee out of Greenwich, UK. Shubhadeep Pal is our supervising editor based out of Mumbai and Singapore. The articles are written by Ayushi Badola in Dehradun in India and Meera Hull in Montreal, Quebec. Creative design is led by Ligia Esteve in Montreal. Baiba Dreamen is the project director for the show based out of Valencia, Spain. Special thanks to Wendy Sim in Singapore. And I'm Shashank Nigam, the CEO of Simplifying and your host. Please feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn.